Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host. Congratulations, HRN. It's our celebrating 15 years of radio, food, drink, and party podcasts, all on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We just celebrated our 700th episode with some Master Cicerones. And now we're celebrating New York City Beer Week, which kicked off with the opening bash the other day at Industry City. And we're at our friend's spot, Gun Hill Public. It's a great spot in the drinks center of Brooklyn, next to Fort Hamilton Distillery, and we're up here. So we have our guests. They're going to introduce themselves. This is going to be quite neat. We're going to talk about everything from how to make a good lager to how to open a brewery. Let's start with our guests.
Pete Lingell Fushimi from Rockaway Brewing Company.
And Nick Meyer from Eckhart Beer Company.
Great. Nick and Pete, thanks for joining me. And thanks to our friends at Gun Hill Public for hosting us today. I started out by drinking the IPA, and we also tasted lagers and everything. What beer did you have at Gun Hill Public, Nick?
I had the pale ale to start out. And as I'm opening a lager brewery, of course, I'm drinking a Pilsner now.
Yeah. And Pete, what did you have?
Pilsner to start, and now I'm on the oat lager.
So talking about one thing, by being here, we're going to talk about New York City Beer Week and the breweries that are thriving and that mean a difference to us. Gun Hill Public is quite unique because it's affiliated with Gun Hill Brewery in the Bronx, but here it's somewhat related but independent, and there's a brewer who does brew most of the beer here on site. What's his name? Pete, you know him. I know him as Jeff.
Jeff, yeah. It's been a while since I've seen Jeff, but I recognize his face and I'm like, what is going on here? Yeah, it's an interesting setup. Yeah.
So there's a guy named Jeff that brews out of here, and we'll keep him mysterious, but it really is a brew on premise operation. They also have some of the classic Gun Hills beers like the Voidalite Stout. It's a great place, and more and more we're doing things in Industry City. Some of the festivals I do, like Rib King in May, Cider Feast in October, Bolozol in October, we're out here at Industry City. So it's just great to be out here. And again, Gun Hill Public, thanks for inviting us out. So we'll get to business. One reason we're here celebrating Beer Week is we're with two breweries. One's open, one's going to be open. And you guys just tell me a little of your backstory. First with Nick. Nick, we met years ago. I know your name, Nick Meyer. You were talking about creating a beer program at French Culinary Institute. So now your background is in hospitality. So tell us about that program, because that seemed to be, was that the first thing that you were doing and that was related to beer?
The first thing I was doing related to beer is most people was I was drinking it. I came from a hospitality background. I cooked in you know, fine dining restaurants. And then sort of phased out of that and got into teaching cooking. I was at French Culinary Institute, and they were teaching a wine program. They did a two-day wine sort of sensory program, which was geared towards teaching aspiring chefs about tasting wine and how wine works as a food beverage. And that was sort of in the first big wave of craft beer where it had started to be taken seriously as a food beverage. So myself and another instructor decided we wanted to try and design a program to talk about beer in the same way, which ultimately wasn't... it didn't get picked up by the school, but it was a really interesting process for us and for me to think about beer and as a food beverage and to taste it more closely. And so that's, I think, where I really started to pay more close attention to the individual components of what makes different styles.
Yeah, and then I remember you'd reach out to me and we're talking about creating the program. Who are some of the other people in the New York City industry that you were friendly with back then? And, you know, did a little shout outs just because you're a pretty experienced guy now from teaching, working in the industry.
Yeah. You know, I had been out of restaurants for a bit at that point, but I, you know, my background, I worked at 11 Madison Park. Of course, the restaurant industry being what it is, you know, a lot of these people have spread all over the place. But they were, you know, 11 Madison Park did paid a lot of attention to beer as pairing with food. I also did a stint at Blue Hill, and they had a really great beer program and got very, very involved with local breweries and pairing food with their beer. So, you know, those are two places that were very influential for me in terms of my culinary training and you know, how I ended up where I am. So.
Wow. And I know you also had a retail shop in the West Village for a while.
Yes, we had a retail beer store on 8th Street called Some Good Beer, which was sadly a victim of COVID. But that was a great experience. I was really wanted to get closer to beer, you know, the beer industry any way I could. And we sort of tried we had a pretty small spot and limited shelf space and wood. So what we tried to do was really be selective about what we were curating there and finding, really good examples of great stuff, whether it was local or imported. That's where I sort of really started to get more interested in sort of the prime examples of any given style of beer. I went on a quest for a while to really try and get more British ales, which proved pretty hard to get here in good shape, from the UK. But we would find, then we would find local breweries who were doing great examples of the stuff too.
Wow, that's great, man. Well, and it's a different experience than most of us off premise, different margins. But it sounds like you really cut your teeth before opening this brewery. And wow, Pete, it's so great to have you back, Brewer at Rockaway. Tell us some of the beers you're making now, because I mean you're still one of my favorite, technically competent and science minded brewers.
We're making the Spectrum. Definitely lager focused. I love lager. We've got a Relk beer up right now. We've got a rice lager. We've got a corn, adjunct lager, a Mexican lager. One of our flagship beers is an adjunct corn lager. We've got classic styles. We've got an ESB, which I brought tonight, which was what launched the brewery. That's one of Ethan's original brews. Of course, hazy IPA, classic IPA, pale ale, sour beer, fruited sours. We're all, doing the full spectrum.
Yeah, with Rockaway, I remember, and again, giving shout outs to breweries in the industry because it's New York City Beer Week. I remember Rockaway really came through with the gold. It was their black gold stout. And it was, 10 years ago or so, if you had, everyone had nitro stout. And for most people, that meant Guinness. And I remember when I had my pub, Jibby's Number 43, we decided what could we do with that line, and Rockaway Black Gold Stout was one of the first New York City brewed nitro stouts that we put on, and I was always proud to put it on because people it moved as well as Guinness.
It's an excellent beer. I tell Ethan all the time, it's one of his recipes too. By trade, he's a sculptor, so I think he kind of sculpts these recipes and, layering in different malts and the hops and the yeast, and he puts things and chisels away, and it's I tell him all the time, it's perfect. I wouldn't touch a thing with this recipe. That beer is perfect. We have Guinness reps come in and go, yeah, well, I shouldn't say that, but we have Guinness reps that come in and drink it.
Oh yeah, no, it fit the bill, and it was what I wanted back then. Is I wanted to try to get as many New York or regional beers to fill styles. I remember when I opened Jimmy's 43, people were still asking for can't even think of the name. What's the thing that the Belgian beer that's the fake golden lager?
Not Duel.
Sorry, I should cancel that. I'm gonna cancel that. Never mind. Anyways, yeah. And then when you got there, Pete, I remember when it was just like the little storefront in Long Island City, and you could go in and you could buy a beer in a covered cup and go across the street to the street market or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's still happening, but it used to be in this very small space, half like 75% of it was the brewery, and the front section was the tap room, which would seat maybe four people. And it's just kind of grown, elongated, like into several buildings in this kind of rabbit's warren of a space. And now it's grown to, starting with a 2-barrel brew house to a 5, now it's a 10, and now we have 50-barrel fermenters. It's like going through pretty good expansion over time, and it's 11-year-old brewery at this point.
Wow, that's amazing. And then just, you know, going back to talking about how I would replace a Guinness line with a New York City brewed nitro stout, like the Rockaway Black Gold Stout. Remember when I first opened Jimmy's number 43, everybody was asking for Stella. And we got a really well-made Belgian Pilsner named Strube through our friends at Be United. And that was kind of how we started out. Was we had different styles of beer, and we tried to get the best one that we could get. And but we're trying to warm up because Nick is actually opening a brewery in Bushwick in Brooklyn. And we're going to kind of grill him on it. And I know Pete's going to coach him a little bit. So the big question is, you know, What beer style are you going to make? I mean, we were talking about every brewery over the years seems like they open, they want to make an oddball style, but they end up selling IPA. I remember when Threes, who I love, when they first opened years ago, they said, we're going to be a Saison only brewery, and not holding anything over them, but we know everyone comes in with good intentions. So you, Nick, tell us about your new project, when it's going to open, and what you're intending to make. And then a little bit about the name and all that. And Pete's going to grill you.
Sure thing. So we're called Eckhart Beer Company, where we'll be opening in Bushwick. We're shooting for late summer 2024. And we will be a lager brewery. We are going all in on traditional German and Czech styles. We're going to try and keep the core beer list pretty narrow, and just work really on producing a consistently excellent product. I think lagers, I mean, there's a lot of movement towards that. I think there are a lot of people who are starting to appreciate them more and more. Both beer aficionados and even people who don't know a lot about beer. Really well-made lagers are appealing to both of those groups. And so, yeah, we'll have a 10-barrel brew house. We're building out the tap room, given my hospitality background. You know, I really think that creating a space where people want to come and stay and, you know, drink, you know, a couple liters of beer over some an extended period of time is what we're shooting for there.
Great. And Pete, you know, you must have questions for him. When he says lager, what are your first questions?
Well, actually, I'm excited to hear a lager brewery coming online locally. I think most breweries these days, even Gun Hill where we're at, are producing lagers. Brooklyn Brewery has been launched with a lager, you know. And it's definitely, the style is hot right now. It's back. Lager kind of went away. It was more associated with like the macro brews for a long time. And ale was the new hot thing that the up and coming kind of grassroots craft brewers were making. But the pendulum has swung back to the center and lager is back for sure. And I'm with Nick on, like, earlier before we started the show, we were talking about lager and why lager. And he's like, I'm in the lager phase of my life. Well, I'm in the lager phase of my life and my brewing career as well. And I'm excited. It is a commitment to say that we're going to make lagers, process-wise and even as far as a business model, because lagers take a lot longer to produce than ales, which is one of the reasons that you hear craft ale. They're a lot quicker. You know, you can turn around an ale in as little as 2 weeks, sometimes even less. And a lager, a good lager, I think, needs a good 8 weeks in the tank. So you got to plan for that. You have to have the fermentation space, and you got to have your schedule set up for this long tank residency, which means it's an opportunity cost loss, because you could have put out several ales in that same time that you got one lager batch coming through. But there's a market for it right now, so I think it's a good time to come on board as a lager brewery.
Pete, I mean, I trust you and your knowledge of beer and you know, your knowledge, believe me. I don't have the language to describe you, but I will say, warnings about lager. And how would you describe that there's a good lager? I mean, I know the taste. I know there's off flavors, but why does a lager take so long to make properly?
Well, the term lager means, it's a German verb, to store. We use it as a verb. So lager, it's like storing. You have to lager the beer. It takes time for all these flavors to marry together. It's like a stew. And you can taste it through its life, during fermentation, all the way through maturation. And you just see it's improving, and it's improving, and it's improving. It's just cutting off and smoothing the rough edges on the beer. So lager just takes time. It's one of the ingredients of lager, and when it's done well.
Why the time? What is the time? I mean, it's not just bells and whistles. It's not like I can run it through a cool ship and cut time. I can pour it out of a lucre and cut time.
There are ways to make fast lagers. One of them being the, you know, warm temperature fermentation under high pressure, which suppresses the esters, the fruity aromatics produced by the yeast. But the classic lager is a cold fermentation. So just by the fact that it's a cold fermentation, it's going to take longer. Things are going to move a lot slower. And there's different phases of fermentation that a lager undergoes, where the yeast is active for a longer period, and it's still metabolizing some things that are going to create some flavors. Some things are going to come together naturally. Some things are going to break apart. Some things are going to drop out of solution in the maturation phase. And the proof is always in the glass. Like, the proof is in the pint. So if you taste it through the maturation, you will see. It finally gets to a point where you're like, okay, it's ready.
Yeah, no, he's coaching me. I would love to come taste your lagers when you open. But why lagers for you again? And what are some lagers that inspire you?
Yeah, so, you know, from my food background, you know, I was always very interested in ingredients, quality of ingredients. So even when I was cooking, I really adhered to this mentality that, like, you get the best ingredients and you do as little as you need to them to allow them to be expressed. I think for me, that's a really important thing about this. And, you know, I'm very excited to try and use as many locally produced ingredients as we can. But, you know, there's a reason that like, you know, the European products have been developed for these beers for a long time. So, like, we'll initially be starting out using, you know, like, the best European malts and hops we can get, and, you know, definitely playing around with local stuff. But yeah, like Pete said, lager brewing is a lot about not allowing certain things to get in the way or like making sure they get taken away throughout the process, whether it's yeast, esters, fermentation byproducts, you know, just handling your wort production so that you're not producing certain things that are going to allow off flavors. Cause all you really want to taste, is those, that grain and those hops. And this is debatable. I think yeast, actually lager yeasts, like, there are yeast characteristics you're going to get in lager. They're not, you know, the same ones you want in ale, but you know, the yeast does make a difference. So that's a part of it. And then process, like in cooking, we call it technique, you know, but it's basically the beer. And this is something I've always been very interested in with brewing beer. And I've done a fair amount of home brewing, is like that the beer tells you whether you got the process right. like Pete said, the proof is in the glass. It's a challenge. I like the challenge of it. It's very meticulous, requires focus and discipline, and that's fascinating to me. And also, it's what I like to drink now. It's very easy to drink. It doesn't demand a lot of you. I mean, you can analyze a lager if you want to, but you can also sit down with your friends and have a good time, and you don't need to pay a lot of attention to it.
So let's talk about your journeys. Pete, I know a number of years ago you went on a motorcycle and you drove down to Bamberg and met up with Joel Shelton. Tell us about that trip. Did it teach anything about German lagers?
Yeah. So I was over in, I had a beer fest I was at in Berlin, but I took a little side trip to go down and meet with Joel and his Inner Circle beer tours, which are amazing, by the way. And it was incredible. We went from brewery to brewery to brewery. He used to be a part of the Shelton Brothers Beer Importers, and they've made excellent friendships with incredible brewers from all over Germany. And most of them, of course, are lager brewers. And they're all very regional. There are different styles, Helles and Pilsner and Northern Pilsner, Friesland Pilsner. And in Bamberg, it's the Rauch beer, the smoked beers, which I love. It did give me an appreciation for the differences in technique. They're also, like Nick's referring to, there's different local ingredients. So the big one being water. So water chemistry is how most of these styles kind of originate. It's the base of beer. So how they originally kind of developed is what works best with this local water chemistry. But again, lagers they're refined, and they're generally pretty similarly tasting, except for like something like an outlier, like a Rauch beer. But when you go and you taste them on a trip like this over a course of several days, you do pick out the nuanced differences between all the breweries, and you ask them, but it's a technique difference, or it's your local, you're using different supplier, or your hops are selected here. So you do have to put it a little bit under a microscope to kind of pick out these nuanced differences. But when you're drinking lager beer, it's quieter. It's not like IPA, like heavy metal music. It's more like classical. We always go to the musical analogy, but you really learn to appreciate it when you delve and you do a deep dive into lager. Yeah, that was a great trip. We also went to Czechia on another trip, which is very different lager brewing tradition and heavily influenced by technique, by process. Open fermentation, for example. And there's an old, one of the breweries we went to in Czechia showed this old manual. I forget who produced it originally. I don't know that it came from Pilsner or Kell, the original, you know, Pilsner brewery that's in Pilsen, where the name came from. But it's all about the process. And a lot of these breweries are using the same process. And there's a point where they move the lager off the yeast prematurely for what most American brewers or German brewers would do. And it leaves a little residual diacetyl, which is part of this Czech lager character. So it's in the book. It's like, and they're just doing some of the newer kind of crafty lager, younger generation lager brewers over there are not doing this premature move. Premature, that's my thing. Like, it's a cultural thing. You know, they are intentionally moving it at this point because they enjoy that the little taste of diacetyl in their product. It's an intentional thing. But from my perspective, it's premature. So I should just put that out there. But just little things like that in the process that lead to a very different beer in the glass. I learned to appreciate process more and tradition and local ingredients with lager brewing and that trip.
And then Nick, for you, your time in Germany, I know you visited, and lager inspiration.
Yeah, my sort of mecca was Augustiner. I couldn't wait to get my first Augustiner Edelstoff. And that's sort of the gold standard in Munich for a Helles. And you know, they're very secretive. You couldn't really learn anything about how they do it, but But man, that beer tastes good. And I also took a side trip to Andex, which is the monastery brewery outside of Munich. I had an export Helles there, which is a slightly stronger version of a Helles, slightly hoppier, that I really loved. And then they make a Doppelbock that's legendary, which is a dark, strong, about 8% lager that, you know, will just blow your mind. I also did a side trip to Prague. I took a side trip to Unetitsky. I was really surprised, actually, when I went to Czechia, by the contrast to the German style, which are very, very clean and very pure malts. And like really like that yeast character is very, very minimal, just malt and hops. Whereas the Czech beers are much more, I want to say rustic, but that makes them sound sort of rough. They're clearly paying a lot of attention to how they taste. They just have they're just got some more character to them, that I would love to know where it comes from. With lager, it's mostly fermentation. But I was really like the beer I had in Czechia. So those were sort of my favorites while I was there. I'm going to try and sort of reproduce that as best I can.
Wow, that's amazing, man. Cheers to you. Pete just poured the Rockaway ESB, which we're going to drink, but I mean, it's a great story, you know, from hospitality. I remember it was like 10 years ago, you were talking about incorporating some beer courses into the French Culinary Institute. You had a retail beer shop. You've really taken the right path of learning about it, and you're going to focus on your hospitality as well. So the good thing is you're not going to be the head brewer, though. You've actually, I think that we were mentioning some of the longtime brewery workers in New York who you guys both know, we mentioned before. You can tell me who they are, but there are people that are helping to set up this brewery, and they're going to be brewing. You want to give shout outs to anybody? Because it's quite a deep well of people in New York City these days.
Yeah, I mean, I have one local who's Justin Sirwa. He's my operations manager, who's worked around here and has been helping me for a long time with the process. I've also been working with consultants. I think one thing I know what I don't know. And so I want to make sure that I'm, especially with an operation like this, where I'm really trying to like make our brand be like the reputation based on quality. I want to make sure I'm building the right thing and not making mistakes that I then have to go correct, which, hopefully the extra money on that is worth, gets paid back by not having to waste time. We don't have a head brewer yet. I'm still in the process of searching, but it's going to be very important to find someone who really understands all the aspects of the process, that are those crucial points to control, so you can control your final product. Because it is, when you're, like Pete said, when you're investing, 6 to 8 weeks in a product, and then, if something goes wrong, that's a lot of commitment and investment to just pour down the drain. One thing I also learned from my restaurant experience was, that you don't put out a plate that's not good. And your reputation will suffer really quickly if you do that. I understand there's a lot of pressure. Like, you've invested this time and labor into this product and you want to put it out. But I really want to make sure that we can control as many things as possible there.
And with your goals, I'm sure you have goals lined up because you're a process guy. What will make you proud in like 2 or 3 years about Eckert Brewing?
The first thing is the hospitality. I want to see people. You see it here too, but in tap rooms in the U.S. But one thing I really appreciated in Germany and Czech was that everyone's at the place having a good time, and that's I think there's a sort of pride in that, and there's obviously a return in terms of people want to come back and buy your beer, which is great. But I also think, you know, I mean, I want to be respected by other people in the business. That's another part of it for me. I think, you know, I would like to be a brewer's brewery, but also be able to be accessible. I think that's sort of the beauty of these beers, is that even if you don't, I had someone use a good analogy. They're like, if you know, you ask people what makes a good, you know, meatball or something like that, they might not be able to explain what it is, but they just know they like it. And I think people understand that. Even people who don't study beer understand that more than they think they do. So,
wow, man, this is a great intro. We're going to take a short break. We're here at Gun Hill Public in Industry City, Brooklyn. It's New York City Beer Week. We're talking with Pete from Rockaway and Nick from soon to open Eckhart Brewing. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's our 15th anniversary, heritageradionetwork.org, also known as HRN. There's some really cool fundraisers going on. Check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. And it's also our 15th season as Beer Sessions Radio. So you can imagine we've been through a lot of beer weeks, a lot of changes and evolution of pub and beer and restaurant and bar scene in New York City and surrounding. It's great to be with two gentlemen who I've known on and off for years. So you got Pete from Rockaway and Nick, soon to open Eckhart Brewing. So we were just hearing a little bit about Nick's inspiration for opening, soon to open Eckhart Brewing in Bushwick, Brooklyn, focus on lagers. Now, Pete Langle,
Fushimi
of Rockaway is going to grill him, ask some questions just about, you can tell me, Pete, what are you going to ask this guy about the build out and other goals that he has for his brewery?
Well, I hadn't really put anything together, but I was interested in maybe your, like, what you're anticipating for your split of tap room and distro, and do you intend to do self-distribution? Are you trying to move into a larger kind of regional market, or what's your focus for your sales?
Great question.
Yeah. You might need to open that beer if you're going to grill me so that I can, you know, I'm getting a little nervous, but, our cellar capacity is about 3,000 barrels, give or take, you know, depending on how fast we can get stuff through there. I intend to take our time. And, you know, our tap room will have about 100 seats in it. From what I understand, talking to people, we'll probably be lucky to sell 1,500 barrels through there in a year. So that means, you know, we have 1,500 barrels excess capacity. We will be self-distributing. We don't have a canning line. We do have a nice keg filler coming in from Germany, to ensure really high quality keg beer. And we'll definitely be doing, draft distribution, that way. We have 3 1,500 liter, overhead serving tanks that we'll be serving from, which are sort of a nice centerpiece to the tap room, and also, save on some labor because you can fill them all at once rather than having to fill a whole bunch of kegs. Ideally I'd like to do as much tap room as possible. You know, it seems like people are doing really well these days with the multiple tap room model. So if you can, you know, make it work to just open another tap room and serve your own beer there, it's a good way to go. So that's our intent initially.
Pete, what are mistakes that people make when they open a brewery?
Well, finances are always one of the, like, a lot of people, including myself, who open craft breweries are not necessarily trained business people. And so we kind of put together these simple, maybe spreadsheets, and we don't really realize all the overhead that's involved and what it costs to operate in, you know, on the day-to-day at brewery. And in New York City, especially, it's extremely difficult because the real estate is so expensive. So we're putting a large, you know, footprint kind of production business into a very expensive real estate market, which makes New York very difficult. Of course, New York is super cool, and it's a city of 10 million people. I don't even know, that number fluctuates all the time. And 5,000 accounts. So you have access to a big market, but everyone's in that market. People send beer from all over the world to this market. So you got to find your niche, and you got to, like, figure out a way to make that work. I've met brewers all over the world. And I remember one trip I went to Buffalo, New York, where everyone was killing it, just killing it. And I discovered that a lot of them own their property and got it for nothing because the city was redeveloping the downtown area and giving away buildings for like a dollar, literally. And that's a huge advantage over a brewer in New York who's paying, you know, $40 a square foot or something. But there are ways to make it work, and you got to think, consider your margins and how you're going to do it. And like Nick mentioned, the multiple tap room idea is the way to do it here, I'm convinced. Like, put a small footprint tap room in high traffic area. I always say you got to go where the fish are. If you're fishing, you got to find the fishing hole. Unless you got really good bait, like Nick's tap room that he's building out, maybe some fish will come over to that, you know, area of the pond and take a nibble. But go where the fish are, and pay the extra dollar for that high traffic, high, you know, real estate for a tap room. It's perfect.
Now you're talking fish. I'm thinking fish and chips at a really good Irish pub. Are you going to serve food? What elements of hospitality, which is your trademark, are you going to embrace? Why should I go to Eckhart Brewing?
Yeah, that's
a real question. Like, why should I go anywhere?
Yeah, I mentioned quality of product, I think, and the fact that, you know, that's, we're going to go, I think it's important, like you said, it's, New York's a very competitive market, all the more important to really define who you are, and really offer something that's unique. So we're building out a tap room, that I think is going to really be special. I'm very excited about the space, just the space and how it's going to, what it's going to be like.
Room for parties?
There'll be, yeah. So we have it's about a 7,800 square foot space, and three quarters of that will be production. And then about 2,500 square feet will be, cheers.
Cheers to Rockaway ESB. Thank you.
2,500 square feet of that will be tap room. We're putting a mezzanine space in, so it'll be sort of broken up into smaller zones, each of which will sort of have its own slightly different feel. And yeah, the food thing, given my background, I almost know too much about cooking, you know, so I maybe not want to do a complicated food program, but the way I'm envisioning it is that people are there to come and drink beer. And I want the food to be surprisingly good. But I want it to support the beer. So, when people call it a brew pub, that makes me a little uncomfortable because it reminds me of sitting down and having a menu and you're at a restaurant, and I want it to be more, you know, again, I don't mean to like idealize Europe, but like you go to a German beer garden, you're sitting there drinking beer, and you drink beer if you're there for an hour and a half or so, and then you say, oh, I need something to eat. And you go, and, you know, there it's sort of cafeteria style usually, but they have a beautiful roasted chicken on a plate, and you take it back and you and, you know, or a nice little prepared salad. We'll have table service, so, you know, you don't, it's not going to be that rustic, but I want to do simple, really tasty food that just sort of supports the beer.
Let me say, I support you doing table service. There's one thing that there's a divide between, like, good hospitality and a typical brewery where you have to go up and order things and get them yourself. And just when you're getting into a groove with the, with your friends, you have to get up to get another round. So I'm a big fan of table service.
Yeah. The other thing for me that I'm super neurotic about is I want people to get their beer almost as soon as they think of it. I think speed of service is a really crucial thing. I mean, when you're ready for another one, you're ready for another one. And to me, as long as you sort of can plan properly and create your systems and train your staff right, there's no reason you couldn't do that.
Talking about keeping the beer flowing, I had a bar 20 years ago, and there was one customer who would come in. He would sit at the bar on a Friday night, and he kept putting down a $20 bill. And he says, you know why I did that? I said, why? He says, because when you see my beer down to like 3 inches left, I want you to right away give me a new one. I don't want to wait till it's empty, and I don't want to ask you.
Yeah, I think that's a very good, important point that you bring up. And it's something that you need to plan for, like your staffing for your bar. Like, of course, bartenders want to get the tips. So fewer bartenders, more tips. But the goal is the experience for the customer. So you have, that's part of your, as you said, training for the staff. The goal is the experience. And this whole beer garden model is perfect, and I think you're going to have a real competitive edge with your culinary background and your hospitality background. From there are some breweries doing pretty good food programs, but not everyone's doing that. Not everyone's, you know, got that added benefit to their experience. Like the other thing, like, is just restrooms. Like, how many restrooms are you going to have? People, if they're in line for the restroom, or if they're in line to, you know, buy a beer, or if they're in line for this or that, or to get food, it slows down your movement behind the bar. So it's good that you have that. That's your experience, you know, in mind.
One more thing about hospitality, too. I mean, a lot of breweries with tap rooms, they are allocating staff to do things, but you have to go up to the counter, and whether you're ordering food or something, you might walk away with a number on a stick. Then there's someone coming out with the food. So that person could also be out there in the dining room or the beer garden with an iPad and could walk around and ask you for your order. So you wouldn't have to get up in the middle of your beer to get another one. I mean, have you thought of like innovative ways to do casual service yet that still feels hospitable?
Yeah, we've had a lot long conversations about, you know, order management and service models and things like that. I recently went to, I went to a local place that had gone to QR ordering over COVID, and which I didn't at the time really like because I like the human touch. And then we went back and they had gotten rid of the QR ordering. And then I said, man, I really miss that. Because, you know, you got servers who are really busy, you know, like you sometimes you can't get their attention. They're out there helping. So
when your drink's running low, you don't want to wait for that refill.
Yeah.
Just because you had to wait for someone to take your order.
So, yeah. So I think what we'll probably do is as sort of a hybrid thing. I think the human touch is really important. And I think I want servers to be walking around and engaging with guests. But I think, you know, what we're leaning towards right now is to have a QR option so that you can, because a lot of the companies now have a very versatile system where you can get on your QR, use the QR code and basically get onto the tab that the server has for you already. And so it's a combined tab. And so if you're ready for a beer, or if one person's ready for a beer, they can order it and it'll show up. But if you, and then the server can also show up and ask you if you need anything. So
the person that runs, like a runner who brings out that beer or food, could also take a reorder too.
Yeah, I mean, we're also trying to, you know, we'd like to have our servers be trained to do anything. I don't know that we're going to be so big that we need runners and servers. I mean, if we're so lucky that we need one person just to deliver beer, then I'll be happy.
Well, it sounds like a family restaurant to me. you know, everyone on the floor can take your order. Everyone on the floor can get you a cup of coffee. It doesn't have to be so specialized that the runner couldn't just say, hey, I can only get you a water. I'll have to get the waiter for you. That, to me, that's always a deal breaker.
Yeah, I hate that too. And, you know, I appreciate that that takes extra diligence in terms of management and ownership and training and stuff like that. But, you know, I mean, I think another part of this business is about attention to detail and hospitality and people really being committed to their jobs. And, you know, you mentioned that, yeah, you know, asked about another thing that would make me proud is, for me mostly, is actually just having employees who like being there and who want to stay. And I know it's challenging in the hospitality industry, and especially in New York. But I think, you know, in my experience, when you understand what people want and really listen to them, it makes a difference in their experience, and they're more productive, you know, as a result.
Well, you know, you're going to do great, because we're talking about hospitality and Nick's lighting up and he's smiling. He's got a lot to say. And back to Pete on beer. So challenges of lagering, Pete.
Yeah. Well, as we mentioned before, like, it's the time, you know, it's going to tie up your food. Time.
He's got a beer on watch.
Yeah. I gotta rack this beer real quick. It's gonna tie up your tank, and so it reduces your overall production capacity. But if you're planned for that, that's fine. Lagers are, you know, IPA is still the number one selling beer, but everyone's producing IPA, so maybe being lager focused will kind of set you apart, be more niche. Challenges of lager. I mean, they're a lot actually cheaper to produce aside from tank residency. Like an IPA, I do like deep dives into cost of goods. They're like a third to cost of goods because of the hops mainly.
They're the first person to say that on the air.
Yeah, IPAs are very expensive to produce. That's why they're expensive to, you know, in the can and at the draft as well. But lagers, that's the other thing. Historically, in this country, the price point is lower for a lager. So that's something you have to consider and work around. Is like, people aren't willing to pay as much for a lager. But if you've set yourself up to produce your 3,000 barrels of lager, and that's the sweet spot, and you're getting the margin that is also in the sweet spot, then you're fine. Like, that's kind of the hard part of this business, especially when you throw in real estate and payroll, your biggest expense, is finding that balancing point and where you're profitable and you're comfortable and the business is thriving.
Pete, so just, you told us a little bit about the original Rockaway, the Black Gold Stout, Ethan's recipe. Well, this ESB, is that also an original Rockaway recipe? And
yeah.
Any secrets to it, or well traditions?
Since we're talking about lagers, I brought an ale. So this
we didn't know that. Yeah. That's why we walked in and we learned that Nick is doing lagers.
But this is the beer that launched Rockaway. That's why it's called the original. And I think this was a recipe that Ethan worked on as a home brewer and got it to a point where people were saying, you should open a brewery. This is amazing. This beer is... it's not the first choice for most brewers to launch as your flagship for a craft brewery, but I respect Ethan that he chose to launch with this beer. And I think nowadays there is a space where people are appreciative of this style, especially as brewers. It's a very big beer. It's got a ton of flavor. It's packed full of flavor. It's not a lager. It's not an IPA. If it was a lager, it would be like an alt beer, which is actually an ale, sorry, or an Urbach. An Urbach, yeah. But it's not exactly a traditional IPA. It's 6.4%. I think Ethan probably landed on that ABV for flavor considerations. Like, alcohol ties a lot of things together. It has a kind of a perceived sweetness to it, and it does have an impact on mouthfeel and flavor. It's a malt bomb, but it's balanced and drinkable. It's got some English hops. It's got some Fuggle kind of orange marmalade, a little bit Earl Grey tea, herbal hop character, and it's got some Cascade. It has a blend of English yeast and American yeast, and it's all about a huge flavor package, but maximum drinkability on top of that, which is difficult to balance. And it's, yeah, I think it's a great beer, so I wanted to showcase it tonight.
Thanks, man. I'm liking it too, and I like when you describe it, I understand it, because there's that malt forward flavor that I like, that I'm not used to drinking. Earlier, Nick, you had said that when you had the retail beer store, you really wanted to go more with English ales. Is this an English style ESB to you?
Yeah, I mean, I really like this. I'm glad you. I was going to ask you the same question. I wanted to know what was behind it. I've gotten very interested in their, you know, these established styles. Now, we were talking earlier off air about how, you know, everyone's sort of trying to reinvent the wheel, and there's some great things coming out of that. I don't want to, you know, badmouth that at all. But I also appreciate that the styles that became traditional got that way for a reason, because they were successful in whatever they did. And I really like this. I mean, an ESB is one of my favorite English styles. I love the balance. I like the, I tend to like those European style hops that have more of that black tea, grassy flavor. The traditional malts. And that yeast character, that was going to be my question for you, is what's the yeast? Because I think that's so defining of that character, especially the English ones.
That is like the one tweak that I made to, with his consent, Ethan's recipes. I did blend in an English yeast to squeeze out a little bit of the ester character, because he used US05, Chico Cal Ale, which is a neutral yeast. It's considered neutral, yeah. Which was a great beer, but I'm like, can we just put a little bit of ester in here? So we do a 50-50 split. So we have it's a little estery. Just to make, I mean, it's not intended to be a traditional English ESB. Obviously, it's 6.4. It's dangerous. It's a dangerous beer. It's slippery. But it's exactly what he intended it to be, and it's not exactly traditional. It's an American hybrid. It's a riff off of the original ESB, and I think it's a great beer.
Nick, just a couple more questions since you're opening and we're trying to get to know you better. When you're talking about your retail store and that you were able to focus on English ales, I thought about my own experience, and the phrase power of the publican. You know, when you're the restaurant owner, hospitality person, you really can dictate taste. It's not like you're forcing people to eat caviar, but you definitely have the power of choosing what style of drink they're going to have, what signature food you're going to have, with the awareness that you also, people want that. You know, so I just want to give you a big shout out, because I know as a hospitality person, that's what's going to set you apart. But is there one thing on your mind that you want to serve? Like you had mentioned English ales, you're doing lagers at the new brewery. Is there something in the food department that you are going to serve that to you just feel like goes with what you'll be doing?
No. I mean, one other thing I'm trying to do in with this business is understand what I'm capable of devoting attention to or not. I will hire a chef, and I have some parameters of what I think I want the food to do, but I want to hire someone who can really put their energy into that and be creative with it. It's sort of a disappointing answer. I mean, I've always, as a cook, I've always been, and I mentioned the roast chicken before, I've always been obsessed with the roast chicken. When I was cooking as a career, that was every Sunday I would roast a chicken.
I know if I went to your place on a Sunday, I could get some roast chicken.
Yeah. Can I get that invite as well?
Yeah. I mean, it was from the same sort of mentality, like I'm going to do this over and over again and just taste it every time and see how it's different every time and try and, get to some ideal state. Right. But it doesn't have to be that. I think.
And what do you serve with the roast chicken?
The classic things are, I mean, we thought about putting a rotisserie in and just going all in on that. But we could still do it. But I'm a big fan of just putting the potatoes underneath and just letting all the juice drip into it. And then that's your side. Have a couple of good fresh salads. I think I love a Bavarian pretzel. Probably have to do that anyway. I don't want to be a German themed place. But it works. I mean, yeah, there's a reason that people eat that with beer.
Wow, man, this has been a great show. We didn't dive too deep into things like overusing lucres or other things that are controversial in the real beer geek community. But this was a really nice introduction to Eckert. Oh, last thing, Nick, why is it called Eckert Brewing? In like 30 seconds.
Thank you for asking, Jimmy. I've been reading a lot of philosophy recently, sort of started over the pandemic. So it's named after Meister Eckhart. He is a 12th century German mystic and theologian. A lot of his sort of philosophy comes down to simplicity, humility, focus, quiet. It's almost like a Zen kind of mentality. And it just really spoke to me as a way to conduct oneself and to sort of present oneself, to run the culture of your business. So it means a lot to me. And I wanted to be reminded of that all the time.
That's cool. And then the last thing, so like here at Gun Hill Public and Industry City, there's a small brew system. Our friend Jeff brews beers just for them, as well as some other beers. And it's nice to come into a small establishment and you know that the draft's going to be fresh and good. But cans, especially, I feel that in pandemic, especially, more and more breweries were making cans. And I've had issues with a lot of canning. Pete, what are some of the issues that can happen with the canning? Because we're going to try to advise Nick as to how he's going to run that part of his operation.
Yeah, so the big one is oxidation. So oxygen is the enemy of beer. And most of the canning lines that preppers are using are called atmospheric. They're not counter pressure. So they're open. And they're going to take some oxygen. If you really learn your machine and you learn how to run it, or you're using a reputable mobile canner, and especially if you're checking with some equipment, such as the Anton Par, you can really dial in your numbers, but you do have to pay a lot of attention to your oxygen pickup. And that's the big one. And then you are going to take a little hit on your carbonation with an atmospheric. So dial that in, anticipate that hit. And then they're pretty complicated pieces of equipment. There's a lot of small parts, soft parts, and a lot of them, like the Wild Goose, are aluminum based, so you can't use heavy like caustic cleaners. So you got to be real tight with your cleaning and sanitation as well, so you don't pick up any contaminants.
Nick, so how are you going to start out with canning?
We'll be using a mobile canner. I'm nervous about it.
You can shout them out if you want to.
We'll be working with Ironheart. Some of the best brewers out there use Ironheart. Hill Farmstead uses Ironheart. Suarez Family uses Ironheart, and they get great results. I think.
And then how many days a month will you be canning?
It's not going to be more than three or four days, probably. I mean, we're going to sell, we will have beer in cans available for retail sale on site. And we'll do some sort of selected distribution to people in the city. Because I think it's really important to get that packaged beer out there, and people want to take it home with them. It's just about communicating with whoever you're working with, that what your standards are. And I think they care as much about the quality as you do, but they're going to follow your lead. So if you ask a lot of them, then they're willing to step up.
Well, I just want to say thanks to Nick and Pete for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. This is a really cool conversation. There'll be many more to come. I would like to say that, wow, we're at like craft brewing 3.0 in New York City, and it's only looking up because guys like Nick are coming in with a hospitality background. No illusions about what it takes, but also they're being smart and working with good people. So We're wishing you the best of luck, Nick, and let us know when Eckhart Brewing opens in Bushwick, Brooklyn on Johnson Ave, right?
Yep.
Out in Bushwick. And Pete over at Rockaway, you took great pride in pouring this ESB. And I know we've had so many conversations on air about Kvikis and everything. You're always a great guest, and I love your beer. So thank you guys so much for joining me.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks for having me.
And big shout out to our engineer, Armin Spengen. And once again, hey guys, celebrating 15 years of Heritage Radio Network, and it's our 15th season on Beer Sessions Radio. So thanks so much, and we'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo. Thank you. Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.